So good afternoon. Thank you very much for your patience as we try to be technical here. I have been talking about church history off and on for quite a few months now, and I'd like to just take you through a quick review. We followed up actually from where Dr. Johns had talked about several of Paul's journeys, and then we took him at the end of his last journey back to Jerusalem with the alms, the offerings that he had collected. We went through his arrest in the temple and the accusations that earned him a trip to Rome and prison, and that perhaps maybe he got out and took a couple of more trips because there's some scriptures that don't seem to be explained by the trips that we have descriptions of in the book of Acts. So maybe he got out and took another trip or two and then was back in and was martyred. Then we left that track for a couple of sermons and looked at how Sunday, interestingly enough, was added to the Sabbath. They were keeping both in a way for a while in the church in the second and third centuries. And then took a break from that and actually just did a whole sermon on the Sabbath that didn't particularly have to do with church history. Now, I'd like to continue and go a little bit more into this transition. I promised you some information on the transition from the first to the second centuries, because there are a lot of things that are different. When you look at the church fathers, as they're called, and you see how they describe the scene in the second century, as early as the second century, with people like Irenaeus and others that were writing early, John Martyr, Justin Martyr, not John. These individuals are talking about a very different church than what we read about in the book of Acts. In some ways, not, I shouldn't say very different, but in some ways different. How did this happen? Oh, that's interesting. I didn't mean to do that. Oh, great. I hope it doesn't do that on every slide, but if it does, we'll just put up with it. I'm sorry. The temple is integral to all of this. What happened between the first and the second century? And I may have mentioned to you that I was planning to talk about the destruction of the temple and how that changed everything in the early church, and it changed everything for Judaism for a while. And then I began doing some research and looking into it and realized that I really couldn't do justice to what it means to have the temple destroyed unless we first established what the temple meant. What difference did it make? What did the temple mean to the average Jew in Judea or in Galilee? What did it mean to the Romans? What did this symbolize? And to not understand that and to try to talk about what it meant when it was gone seemed to me that it wouldn't work. In fact, it would be a little bit like trying to explain the significance of what we call 9/11 now to someone who had no familiarity at all with the fact that New York City is our largest city, that these giant buildings there at the World Trade Center were some of the tallest buildings on Earth and all this type of thing, and what it symbolized and why our enemies decided to attack those buildings. If you didn't understand all that, you wouldn't know what was so important about 9/11, other than, you know, it was significant what happened. It was a historical event, but it symbolized a lot more. And you understand that because you live here. But we don't live in Judea, and we don't live in the first century. So perhaps when we read in a history book, read in Josephus, that the temple was destroyed by the armies, the Roman armies, maybe that doesn't mean as much to it. To us, certainly it doesn't mean as much to us as it meant to those in the first century. And I'm going to try to do what I can to, in a short period of time, add to your understanding, I've added to my own understanding, so that we can get a little more of a feel for what the temple meant. And at first, I'm going to go back in history here in a little bit, but let's just look and see what the temple meant to those early on. in the New Testament we read about. Now, Jesus himself entered the temple, and he began to drive out those who were selling, saying to them, "It is written, my house shall be a house of prayer, but you've made it a robber's den." These are all quotes from the New American Standard, 95 revision. That's from Luke 19. So Jesus thought the temple was important enough that he went in there and said, "Look, it's my Father's house. We need to clean up. You need to clean up your act here." There was a lot of, you might say, corruption involved with the administration of the temple. Now, here's another scripture in Luke. It's talking about Jesus said during the day he was teaching in the temple, but at evening he would go out and spend the night on the mount that is called Olivet. And all the people would get up early in the morning to come to him in the temple to listen to him. So Jesus taught in the temple. When he was being accused by the chief priests and the temple police, if you want to call them that, he said to them, and they had come with all these charges, accusations. He says, "You come here with swords and clubs like you would against a robber, while I was with you daily in the temple and you did not lay hands on me?" Jesus says, "I was there. I was there every day. You had a problem with me. Why didn't you do something then?" How about in the early church, after Jesus had died and he was resurrected? It says, when the day of Pentecost had come, they were all together in one place. Suddenly there came from heaven a noise like a violent rushing wind, and it filled the whole house where they were sitting. We read that in Acts chapter 2 and verse 1. It says the whole house. Maybe they were in a house. But it's also possible, because that word is translated house, it certainly means house. But it's also in several instances in the New Testament refers to the house of God. So is it possible? I don't know that we could be certain one way or the other, but it's entirely possible that in Acts chapter 2 that they were in the temple courts, because they certainly did get a crowd gathered pretty quickly. If they were holed up in some kind of a house, as we would envision it anyway, they wouldn't have gathered a crowd. So they were at least somehow or another they were in the open, and perhaps an argument could be made, and some commentaries say it could have been that way, argument could be made that they were in the temple. Whether or not they were then, I wrote Luke there, that should be Acts. Day by day, continuing with one mind in the temple. The early Christians were in the temple from day to day. Peter and John went up to the temple at the ninth hour, the hour of prayer, in Acts chapter 3 and verse 1. So this was a habit that we have in the New Testament, and they were involved in going to the temple as part of their worship. Notice that the high priest got perturbed at the apostles early on in the book of Acts, chapter 5. And the high priest, along with his party, the Sadducees, were filled with jealousy. They laid hands on the apostles and put them in a public jail. But during the night, an angel of the Lord opened the gates of the prison, and taking them out, he said, "Go stand and speak to the people in the temple," the whole message of this life. And upon hearing this, they entered into the temple about daybreak and began to teach. So this was the venue where the apostles taught early on in the history of the New Testament church. It says here later on in Acts chapter 5 that every day in the temple and from house to house, they kept right on teaching and preaching Jesus as the Christ or Messiah. So the temple was important to the early church. They were involved in it. All right, we'll go here. How about for Paul? Paul, in Acts 20, says he had decided to sail past Ephesus so that he would not have to spend time in Asia, for he was hurrying to be in Jerusalem, if possible, on the day of Pentecost. Why did Paul want to be in Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost? Anybody? It's not a trick question. Go ahead. He wanted to keep the feast. Why did he want to go to Jerusalem to keep it? That's where the temple was. Even somebody who wasn't a resident, local resident that could go there easily, they would often travel to Jerusalem to observe, what did they call them? A pilgrimage festival, or that's the term we use, a pilgrimage festival. They went, they took a long journey. And you remember in Acts chapter 2, there were people from all over the empire that were there observing Pentecost. Why were they there? Because that's where the temple was. Paul, when he came back, and this is where we started this series of sermons, when he came back to Jerusalem, he was involved in the rites involved with ending and concluding a Nazarite vow, both probably for himself and definitely for some other men. And he paid their expenses, which were considerable. It wasn't just loose change. It was a great amount of money that he had to pay in order to pay for their sacrifices. So Paul, even later on, this is going on into, I didn't look up the date. Would it be in the 50s probably? Early 50s? He's in...
He's about to be arrested. It's late
50s. Late 50s.
57, 58.
Okay. In the late 50s. He's still, he's involved with the temple. And he came back to Jerusalem and participated in some temple rites. Since the temple was important to the early church, a full understanding of early church history must consider the impact that the temple's destruction had on the church. But, as I've already said, the only way to properly assess this impact is to reconstruct the institution of the temple itself. How did the average church member in the first century, or for that matter, how did the average Jew in the first century, view the temple? What difference would it make if it were not there? Did it matter at all? Let's go back in history. This obviously is not the temple that was there when Jesus was on the earth in human form, but this is a picture, someone's concept of the tabernacle in the wilderness. And we've had, Mike's talked about that and actually constructed one. So we have a little bit of history about that, and I won't spend a long time. But if we're going to talk about the temple, we need to realize it goes back in history. In fact, if you want to read the Jewish sages, they'll say it goes back to, they'll talk about Abraham and Cain and Abel and Adam. I mean, Abraham being perhaps sacrificed or being ready to sacrifice his son on the, perhaps the very site that the temple ended up sitting. I don't know that that's important one way or another, but my point about bringing that out is that to the Jews talking about the temple, they don't just go back to the tabernacle, they go back ancient history. Here's what God said in Exodus. Let them construct a sanctuary for me that I may dwell among them. Notice I highlighted that. According to all that I'm going to show you as the pattern of the tabernacle and the pattern of its furniture, so shall you construct it. Why did God want a tabernacle constructed? He says here in Exodus that I may dwell among them. And that's a whole other subject, an interesting subject. That in one sense, if you want to look at it, I don't know that I've spoken this here, but I've spoken it at a feast before. In one sense, the Bible from the beginning to the end is the story of God wanting to dwell with man. And the fact that we are continually pushing him out and saying, no, no, no. Somebody else talk to him. We don't want to talk to him. Whatever. Our sins separate us from God. Our own desires. The Israelites said, no, we don't want to talk to him. We don't want to listen to him, Moses. You go talk to him. It's throughout history. Man has constantly been pushing God away, but God intends to dwell with his creation. And that was the reason he gave for constructing a tabernacle, a portable temple, if you would, in the wilderness. In fact, the word temple is translated temple in various places when the subject is the tabernacle. So the main concept of the tabernacle is that it would be the place where God would dwell with his people. Specifically, of course, you've had this discussion before. Yep, got to turn the battery around. You've heard this before. It's the Holy of Holies, right? Where God is pictured as dwelling. I should have done this for you earlier. You see a cutaway version there. It's not big enough really for you to see much detail. And it's not my purpose to go into detail of the tabernacle here. But as I write here on this, there's a Holy of Holies back in there. As I write on this slide, it's not incidental to the topic that this is the place where God would dwell with his people. This is actually a very important point, and it is central to the worldview of the Jews and, Christians who were also Jews in the early New Testament. It was certainly the worldview of the Jews in the area of Jerusalem when Jesus came on the scene. That God dwelled with his people in the place where he did that, the place where the interaction took place, was at the temple. Now, we don't think of it that way. We think the interaction takes place while we're on our knees and we pray, and it does. It certainly does, and that's one of the beauties of the time that we're in, that we have access to the throne of God. But that's not the way they viewed it. They viewed it in a very real way that the temple was the place where they had interaction with their God. I have quite a few verses here. I don't know if I'll read them all. But once we get to the promised land, we have David who wants to build a temple. He wants to build a permanent house for God rather than this temporary structure that can be moved, although it has stayed in one place there for quite a while by the time David's around. David assembled at Jerusalem all the officials of Israel, the princes of the tribes, the commanders of the divisions that served the king, and the commanders of thousands, the commanders of hundreds, and so forth, overseers of all the property and livestock belonging to the king and his sons. We're only two kings into it, and it's already got a big bureaucracy. You notice that? We're only a second king. We already got all these people. God warned him about that. Belonging to the king and his sons, with the officials of the mighty men, and even all the valiant men. King David rose to his feet and said, "Listen to me, my brethren and my people. I had intended to build a permanent home for the ark of the covenant of the Lord and for the footstool of our God. So I had made preparations to build it." He had all these plans. "But God said to me, 'You shall not build a house for my name, because you are a man of war and have shed blood. Oh, of all my sons, for the Lord has given me many sons, he has chosen my son Solomon to sit on the throne of the kingdom of the Lord over Israel. He said to me, "Your son Solomon is the one who shall build my house and my courts, for I have chosen him to be a son to me, and I will be a father to him." So David wanted to build this house. And I'm going to read maybe a little more than I would otherwise, because, again, if you were in the early church, you were Jewish, you had all these scriptures in your head. You knew that David had laid out the plans for this building and that it was important to him and that he gave these plans to Solomon, as it says here later on in 1 Chronicles 28, gave to his son Solomon the plan of the porch of the temple, its buildings, its storehouses, its upper rooms, its inner rooms, the room for the mercy seat, the plan of all that he had in mind for the courts of the house of the Lord and for the surrounding rooms, and for the storehouses of the house of God, and for the storehouses of the dedicated things, the divisions of the priests. He had all this elaborate organization for who was going to serve in the temple and when, and how that was all going to work, how the Levites would all serve and do the work of the service in the house of the Lord, all the utensils, the golden utensils. He had all this. He had donated a lot of his personal fortune, and a lot of the Israelites had donated so that they'd have the material to make the utensils of the temple. There was a lot of preparation. A lot of preparation for this over a lot of years. And it talks about here, and it doesn't give the details, but there are other scriptures that give how much weight of this and that and the other. The lampstand, the golden lamps, the tables for the showbread, silver for the silver tables, the forks, the basins, all this was planned out. And David, I'm sure, was very involved in that and enjoyed doing that, but he wasn't allowed to build it. And can you imagine? If you ever get real excited about something, looking forward to working on a project, and you just can't wait. You can't wait to get started. And David's ready to start. God says, "No, you can't do it. I'm not going to let you do it. You can write up all detail you want and give it to somebody else. Give it to your son." That must have hurt, but that's what the scriptures tell us. All this, notice it says at the end there, said David, "The Lord made me to understand in writing by his hand upon me all the details of this pattern." Now, this is in line with what we read before, that Moses was given a pattern for constructing the tabernacle in the wilderness. Now, David says, or whoever's writing this here, says that David was given this pattern also. He was given a pattern for how to design the temple. Here's a depiction of the temple of Solomon. King David said to the entire assembly, "My son Solomon, whom alone God has chosen." Of course, that was important because there was a lot of fighting among David's sons as to who was going to be king. "Is still young and inexperienced, and the work is great, for the temple is not for man, but for the Lord God." So this temple is not to be for man. It's to be for God. And that's something to remember for us. And it's something that throughout history, the Israelites would have been good to remember. Notice in Deuteronomy, we read that "You shall sacrifice the Passover to the Lord your God from the flock and the herd, in the place where the Lord chooses to establish his name." Where is that place? That's right here. That's this building right here, okay? Right there. That's where God ended up placing his name. Now, some of you, probably like me, were in an environment where God chose to place his name in you know, an island in the Atlantic or mountains in Pennsylvania or wherever. That's not really what it was talking about in the book of Deuteronomy. It's talking about where the sanctuary would be in the land when they entered, you know, when they crossed Jordan. God was going to place his name somewhere, and that's where the center of worship was to be. That's what those scriptures are talking about. So now the Holy of Holies, when Solomon built this, the Holy of Holies had a permanent home. The Ark had a permanent place where it could stay. And this is an important development in the mentality, if you want to put it that way, of the Israelites, of the Jewish people later. Now this is just a depiction, but again, it's at least shows, I don't know how well you can see it, but at least shows that we have this mount. You know, we have a place that's higher than the surrounding area. You've got the Kidron Valley down here, and you've got, this is going downhill as well, and you've got Jerusalem, which is fairly high, but this is higher than much of the rest of Jerusalem. And so it was a prominent location. And that's important, too, to think of. And we'll see some video clips that, oh, boy, that is small there. We'll see some video clips that give us an idea of the scale of this building, these buildings, not this particular one. Thus, all the work of Solomon that Solomon performed for the house of the Lord was finished. And Solomon brought in the things which David his father had dedicated, even the silver and the gold and all the utensils, and put them in the treasuries of the house of God. And Solomon assembled to Jerusalem the elders of Israel and all the heads of the tribes, the leaders of the father's households of the sons of Israel, to bring the ark of the covenant of the Lord out of the city of David, which is Zion. And all the men of Israel assembled themselves to the king at the feast that is in the seventh month. So this is a big deal. It's a big deal. This temple was completed about 962 B.C. I got that from a reliable source. It's Hugh Buchanan's Excel spreadsheet on timelines that he worked on when he was laid off. It was around then. And it was destroyed by Babylon in 586 B.C. I didn't add it up, but that's a little less than 400 years, 380 years or so. What is it? You know. Anyway, it lasted for a while, but it didn't last forever. Solomon's temple. Built for God, but, well, there were problems. I won't go into that right now. Then we know that Israel, after they went into captivity, after the Jews went into captivity, some of them were able to come back to the land. And we've talked about that in previous sermons. Cyrus made a decree, and I won't read through all of this, but it says that that Cyrus was led by God to tell the Jews they could go back to Jerusalem. They could rebuild the city. They could rebuild the temple. And he encouraged them here, wherever they lived, to support him with silver and gold and goods and cattle and freewill offering. So go back, rebuild your center of worship. You have my blessing. And if you don't want to go back and help, send some money, send some goods to help with the project. It didn't just happen right away. It took a while. This decree was in 539 B.C., you know the story. There were prophets that were sent. They were more worried about building their own homes and rebuilding the temple and so forth. Ezra and Nehemiah finally encouraged the people and some of the prophets to get the job done. And in the end, when the temple was ready to be dedicated, King Cyrus brought out the articles of the house of the Lord, which Nebuchadnezzar had carried away from Jerusalem. Now, Nebuchadnezzar was a Babylonian, right? In the meantime, the Persians were the world rulers, and they still had the goods from the original temple, and they gave them back, they gave what they did have anyway, back to the Jews, and they were able to take them back to Jerusalem. So that's good. And this temple was much smaller, according to Ezra chapter 3 and verse 12, much smaller than the temple of Solomon. And it was completed here, according to Ezra 6, in the third day of the month Adar. It was the sixth year of the reign of King Darius, and I was going to put the date down, I didn't, but it took more than just a few years because they didn't work on it steadily. The second temple, and we've gone, I'm not going to spend any time on this. Some of you didn't hear the sermons, and I'm sorry, but they may still be on the website. I don't know. But we've talked about the Assyrians under Antiochus Epiphanes, or the, you know, really the Greek influence, and all the battles that took place with Jerusalem kind of in the middle between the Ptolemies in Egypt and whatever they were called up there in Syria, and there was a lot. There were a lot of battles that Jerusalem just kind of was in the crossfire. And after one of these, Antiochus Epiphanes came and polluted the temple and defiled it. And later on, the Maccabees got the upper hand. They cleansed the temple. They were the forerunners of the Hasmonean dynasty, which was the forerunners, actually, of the Herods in the time of Jesus. We've been through all that before, and I don't have time to go into that today. However, I don't think I mention it here, but we need to understand, as part of the mentality that the Jews had at the time of Jesus, that this second temple was defiled by the Greeks, right? And the Maccabees and their family and all the band of guerrilla warfare type people that were with them were able to take control, and they cleansed the temple, and there were miracles and all of this. This is part of the history of the Jewish people at the time of Christ. It's kind of like one if by land, two if by sea, right? Lexington, the shot heard around the world. All these type of things on July 4th, you know, 1776. The kind of things we have in our mind here about our history and our heritage, the Jews had the same thing, only they were thinking back to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, but then more recently they're thinking back to the Maccabees, who are their heroes, and who had given them, for at least a little while, the semblance of self-rule and being in control. And they actually pretended to be ruling themselves during the Roman occupation, but obviously they weren't. But in a way, they were given a lot of latitude as long as they cooperated. Herod the Great, who we've also heard about, and Dr. Johns has spoken about him and the rest of the Herods. Herod the Great died, if I remember correctly, the year that Jesus was born. And he was the one who began to greatly expand this temple and basically rebuild it. But he was very careful to rebuild it in such a way that the worship never had to stop. And in fact, there were certain areas that if I was, you know, the local carpenter and I could go in there and try to do some work, there are certain areas that I wouldn't be allowed to go in. So what happened? Herod made sure that Levites and priests were trained. Priests in particular. Priests were trained to do the different manual labor that was required in the areas where the average construction laborer was not allowed to go. So they became masons or carpenters or whatever they needed to become. And Herod the Great and his children and grandchildren and so forth, they were not known for doing anything halfway. They were gung-ho, and they were definitely known for great building projects. And this Temple Mount, this area, was one of the big building projects. There were others. Caesarea or Caesarea. I heard it pronounced Caesarea. Jim, you know how, you ever heard that? I don't know how the C is pronounced in Latin, but she pronounced it Caesarea. But they built that huge city up there on the Sea of Galilee, right? But he had huge building projects, and he was known for that. And they were beautiful. They were beautiful, no doubt about it. I mean, when he built something, he might have built it with, you know, who knows? He might have been killing the people that he used to build it, and he was known for being ruthless. But the public works that the Herods were behind were fantastic. Construction began in about 20 B.C., Josephus reports that the building was complete in less than 2 years, the original the building of the temple. But the Herods had big plans, and construction on the entire temple complex continued for many decades. In fact, if we read here in John chapter 2, in verse 19, Jesus answered them, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." And the Jews said, "It took 46 years to build this temple, and you will raise it up in 3 days?" And he was speaking about his body, the temple of his body. But why did they say 46 years? My guess is that it had been 46 years since Herod began to build it, and it was a work in progress. It was kind of like the Capitol Beltway, if you ever drive around Washington, D.C. They're always building on part of it somewhere, right? You guys live down there now. It's never complete. As soon as they finish widening it here, they start somewhere else. And that's kind of the way it was at the temple in the time of Christ. They were building, you know, they complete one part of the project, and they start somewhere else. One source I looked at said it was under construction basically till about 60 AD. Well, that was only a few years before it was destroyed. So that would make about 80 years worth of construction. But the temple itself apparently was completed relatively quickly, at least the basic part of it. So the 46 years here that the Jews mentioned seem to be referring to the number of years since construction started. By the way, there's a model, I guess it's outdoors there, that you can see. This is the model of Herod's temple. And we've talked about this before. This isn't a very big picture, but there you got the main part of the temple. This would be east over here, right? This Kidron Valley would be down here. Notice this. What is this? Somebody tell me. We've talked about it a number of times. What?
Fortress Antonia.
So the Romans are right there, okay? Right there on the wall. Here's another picture looking from the northeast. Now, you can't tell from this picture. We'll see it better in a video later. But that is a tall building. If they have the dimensions correct, and I'm no expert here, if they have the dimensions correct, when you see scale models of this with people standing in that doorway, they're tiny. And some of the commentaries say that the height of that this particular, when I say the temple, we're talking about the holy place, the Holy of Holies right here, that the height of that structure is about 180 feet. That's, what, 15, 16-story building? Maybe. That's huge. Especially huge in a place like Jerusalem, where everything's kind of flat. I mean, not it's built on hills, but I'm talking about the buildings. They don't have skyscrapers there. Okay, why was the temple important? Well, it was where God said he would have his presence. But here's another good reason. Deuteronomy 12, verses 1 through 6 say, these are the statutes and judgments which you shall carefully observe in the land which the Lord your God, or Lord the God of your fathers, has given you to possess as long as you live on earth. Utterly destroy the places where the nations whom you shall dispossess serve their gods, on the high mountains, on the hills, and under every green tree. I skip a verse there and go on. It says, you shall not act like this toward the Lord your God, but you shall seek the Lord at the place which the Lord your God will choose from all your tribes to establish his name there for your dwelling. There shall you come. You get that? Sacrifices were not a new thing when Abraham came on the scene or when Moses came on the scene. But the typical, from what we understand and what we can see archaeologically, heads of households, perhaps, heads of clans, whatever, would sacrifice. And they have a place near their house or at their house or whatever where they sacrifice. In some pagan cults, you would have gods of the fireplace or whatever. Maybe you sacrifice something right there. I don't know. But you sacrifice anywhere. With Israel, it was going to be different. God said, I want to have one place. And the sages said, one God, you know, one temple for one God. So we're going to have one place, and there you bring your tithes. There you bring your offerings. There you come. There you come to worship. The temple was the only center of cultic worship. Cult is not a negative thing. Cult means the kind of worship you can only do when the special people are there with the special understanding. That's the priests and the Levites. They're the only ones who can offer the sacrifices. That makes it, and they can only do it in one place. That's in Jerusalem. So in that sense, it's a cult. And that's a good thing. It's the way it's designed. So you have offerings. And I don't have it in here on a slide, but I just want to point out that the word that's translated in the Old Testament, one of the words that's translated offering, is like in the New Testament. Remember when Jesus was talking about Corban, that when you dedicate something to the temple, and he was criticizing the Jews because they would dedicate something to the temple and deprive their parents, their aging parents, of whatever support that was needed. And he says, you disobey the fifth commandment by not honoring your parents by dedicating something to the temple. And it was called Corban. That's just a direct transliteration from the Hebrew. The offering was Corban, or Korban, or however you would say that. The concept behind Korban is not a sacrifice, like where you're giving up something, or you're killing an animal. That's not the concept. The concept behind that word is a drawing near to God. A drawing near to God. And when you think about offerings or sacrifices in that sense, maybe that gives us a different perspective and a better perspective and a more accurate perspective that's closer to the way a pious Jew or a pious Israelite in older times would look toward the temple. That it was where you would draw near to God. And I didn't cause you to call one of my employees who works on a, grew up on a farm, still works on one. But if you were to offer a burnt offering, a bullock, a first year, anybody have an idea how much a bull that's a year old would cost today? I should have called him and found out. Any guesses?
More than a dollar.
More than a dollar. I agree. That's all?
Oh, a full year?
Full year? I don't know. I would have thought more, but I don't know.
Probably about $245
Hundreds of dollars. Whichever. I mean, I agree with you. We'll take your low figure. It's still hundreds of dollars. I would think it'd be more than that, especially if it's something you could breed with later. If I were to come up here, and I'm not going to do it to make a point, because I can't afford it. But if I took a few $300 bills out of my wallet, if I would have $300 bills in my wallet, and held them up in front of you, and took a lighter and lit them and burned them, you'd all think I was crazy. Probably. But, and I'm not going to get into sacrifices now because it's not the topic. But that's what a pious Israelite or a pious Jew was doing when he took a burnt offering to the temple. Because that burnt offering was not an offering for sin. It was an offering to draw near to God. An offering to draw near to God. And they spent what to us would be hundreds of dollars, and it was entirely burned up on the altar. Nobody got anything. No footballs, no shoes, no steaks, no hamburger, no nothing. You think about that. And this was in Jerusalem. You had the center of this industry, really. I mean, it turned out to be an industry. But you had, you know, what would amount to thousands and thousands of dollars worth of value going through and being sacrificed. Some of it was sacrificed for other things other than burnt, you know, typically burnt offerings. And certainly there were many sacrifices where different people got to share from the goods. But this is a huge enterprise. And to the Jew, it was a way of getting near to God. Getting near to God. And I'll talk about that maybe sometime later. The only place you could do it was Jerusalem. Herod's temple was beautiful and it was imposing. No expense was spared. It sat atop the prominent hill in Jerusalem. The symbolism was clear. Israel's God was the God of creation, the one true God. We have one temple for one God. And the Romans were in control. Antonia Fortress was right there, as we pointed out. Notice Acts 5, a little later. Now, I think we read this before, but remember the apostles were put in prison because they were preaching in the temple, and then they were released. God released them. The angel told them to go back in the temple and preach. They entered the temple about daybreak, began to teach. When the high priest and his associates came, they called the council together, even the senate of all the sons of Israel, and sent orders to the prison house for them to be brought. Why was the high priest and this council there at the temple? Because, as you can see in this depiction, the Sanhedrin, which is the high court, like the Supreme Court of Jewish society, had chambers in the temple complex. It was their Supreme Court. There also, if you read into it from the, I don't know where it is, Mishnah Talmud or somewhere, there were apparently a couple of lower courts there too, smaller courts. But they had chambers right there in the temple. So not only is it the center of cultic worship, not only is it where God draws near to his people and his people can draw near to him, but it's also the place where judgment kind of comes from the temple in a way, because that was where the Sanhedrin was housed. Now, in addition to that, we've got the leadership of the temple, which is the high priest and his Sadducean family and buddies. They are in cooperation with the Roman occupiers. That's how they get to be high priest and leaders, because they are co-opted by the Romans. And they provide leadership for this society under the Romans. So the Romans give them a lot of leeway. There's a Roman governor there, but he only gets involved if he needs to. If the Jews get out of hand, which happened relatively frequently. But as long as everything was peaceful, they left him alone. And the high priest, the rest of the Sadducees, the temple leadership could have their way, operate their concessions in the temple, make a lot of money, and have their power. And they were happy to have it that way. There were other Jews that were not as happy. You've heard of, as we mentioned before, Simon the Zealot. There's one party that didn't like the Romans and wanted to overthrow them, actively involved. The price for the cooperation of the Romans had been for many years Roman control of the temple leadership and the power to appoint the high priest. The high priesthood and the whole associated temple ruling power was, according to what we can read in history and according to contemporary now scholarship, the leadership was widely viewed as being somewhat corrupt. And some people viewed it very corrupt. The Essenes left Jerusalem altogether, went out to the rocks near the Dead Sea, and decided to become hermits in a way and have their own society. It seems to be a kind of protest against the corruption in Jerusalem. So the temple symbolized God's presence, the center of worship. If you want to think about it like the Taj Mahal or the National Cathedral down in Washington or the Vatican. Anybody been to the Vatican? I mean, that's impressive. It's massive. Or Westminster Abbey. God's presence is there. That's where we draw near to God. God's victories. It was a symbol of what God had done in the lives of those Jews and those Israelites. It was in a sense symbolic of Israel's heroes. And again, I'm saying think Dunkirk, think the White Cliffs of Dover, think Independence Hall, think L'Arc de Triomphe in Paris, think Mount Rushmore. Think of that. That's our symbols that maybe we're familiar with. That was I'm giving you a lot of things to think about. For the Jews, that was all in one place. All of these concepts were in one place, the temple. God's rule and justice. Think the White House, Buckingham Palace, or Versailles. Think, you know, whatever, some other thing that you might mean something to you. This is all captured in the symbolism of the temple. It was the point of access to God that we have when we get on our knees anytime we pray. For them, it's like they go to the temple. It was a special access to God. The temple was the center of the Jewish people's identity. It represented what they were. It was very much a part of who they were and what they were. And as I read the scriptures earlier, in the early church, they had no reason to dissociate themselves from that feeling and that approach. I just wanted to throw this in here. Where did the Jews immerse people? The Jewish, you know, typical Jewish leaders. Where did that happen? And I don't mean just in a mikveh. Where were these things?
They were outside the temple wall.
Outside the temple wall. And
near the stairs.
Huh?
Near the stairs.
Yeah, but they were near the temple. They were near the temple, not in the temple. They were near the temple. I think they might have had some inside for the priests to purify themselves. But for the average Jew, it was outside. And in Jerusalem, near the temple. I just want to point something out here about the early church. We read in Matthew 3, the first six verses, "In those days John the Baptist came, preaching in the wilderness of Judea, saying, 'Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand.' For this is the one referred to by Isaiah the prophet when he said, 'The voice of one crying in the wilderness, make ready the way of the Lord, make his path straight.' Now John himself had a garment of camel's hair and a leather belt around his waist, and his food was locusts and wild honey. Then Jerusalem, all these people were going out to him." Out. They had to go out to where he was. Why? Because he was near Jerusalem. I mean, he was near the Jordan. "All Judea and the district around Jordan, and they were being baptized by him in the Jordan River, and they confessed their sins." Now, I hadn't thought about this before, but in preparing this sermon, I ran into this somewhere. I forget where I ran into it. But when you wanted to immerse somebody, you did it in Jerusalem. If you were a priest or, you know, some leading Jew or whatever, whoever would do that, it was in Jerusalem. It was near the temple. It was in the context of the temple cult where the worship was. But if you were John the Baptist, you weren't part of that establishment. You weren't part of that establishment. And you were perceived as not being part of it. You're out there on your own in a way. He's out there and he's immersing people in the Jordan River. And I think it's a good case to be made that he was perceived to be somewhat of a threat to the establishment. And he was willing to speak out, and of course he died. He died, he was killed by Herod for his trouble, by speaking out. And Jesus came along later as a disciple, appearing to be a disciple in a sense of John. And there was a connection there. And I'm sure Jesus was viewed somewhat the same way. Okay, that's the last PowerPoint slide I have. But what we'll do here is look at some videos. And I may interrupt them and talk. We'll see how that goes. This will summarize, plus give you some pretty pictures. If I interrupt, it's going to be because I disagree with what the presenters are saying, perhaps. But we'll see.
Central to the story is the fact that Jesus was born a subject of the Roman Empire.
I might not have it up loud enough. You can turn it down.
And in those days, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed.
Jesus was born during the reign of the Emperor Augustus in the sort of a booming economy of the Pax Romana, the Roman peace. And on every coin that Augustus had were the words Divi Filius, son of the divine one, Julius Caesar, son of God.
Okay, I just want to make a point there. Remember we talked about in Rome, when you adopted, the scripture says the adoption, and we think that's like a second-class citizen or a second-class child in a way. At least it maybe have that connotation in modern times. In Roman times, that was even more significant than being a natural-born child when you were adopted. And Julius Caesar adopted Octavian to be his son. That means he's going to be the next Caesar. Remember that? So that's he's son of God. Octavian or Augustus Caesar is right on the coins. It says son of God, Julius Caesar being God. So you realize the mentality here in the Roman Empire.
This is on every billboard in the Mediterranean world. He is the savior of the world, and he brings the peace. Now, you may have scruples about how he brings the peace, but he brings peace to Rome. And as the saying goes in Latin, peace to the Rome and quiet to the provinces.
This is he, Augustus Caesar, son of a god, who shall restore the golden age and spread his empire.
Rome's empire spread across the Mediterranean, sweeping through North Africa and reaching as far west as Spain. To the east, it encompassed Egypt, Turkey, Greece, and Palestine, where Jesus was born in the Jewish land of Judea, then ruled by King Herod.
And Judea, the King Herod, was in effect a client king. He ruled almost in place of Rome. He was the voice of Rome, the instrument of Rome. Probably instrument of Rome is best in that, because he had his own independent notion, certainly.
Herod the Great was probably one of the greatest kings of the post-biblical period in Israel, but you wouldn't want your daughter to date him. He was ambitious, brutal, extremely successful.
And it is one of the real untold ironies of Jewish history that this man, who's the guy you love to hate in Jewish history, really, leaves the most indelible mark on the face of the land of Israel.
It appears that Herod thought of Jerusalem as his showpiece. He really wanted to make it a place where people would come, just as people would have gone to Athens or Rome or the great cities of the Mediterranean world.
A meticulously accurate model of ancient Jerusalem shows the extraordinary scale of Herod's building program.
And so when Herod built the city, or helped to rebuild the city, he did so on a monumental scale. And this can be seen in the rebuilding of the temple.
We know exactly how Herod rebuilt the temple because detailed descriptions of the architecture have survived. Along the coast, Herod constructed an aqueduct 40 miles long. It brought water to a new seaport he had built. In honor of the Roman Emperor Caesar, Herod named the city Caesarea.
The lady the interviewed called it Caesarea. She was the one that said Caesarea.
We really need to get a feel for a city like Caesarea Maritima at the time of Jesus, precisely because it shows the crucial intersection of Roman rule in Jesus' own homeland.
In this thriving seaport, the power of Rome, its culture and commerce, commanded every aspect of daily life. Into this political climate, Jesus was born. The Gospels present the familiar account of his birth. Despite its Greek and Roman influences, Sepphoris was a thoroughly Jewish city, and Jesus remained faithful to his religious heritage when he left Nazareth to become a preacher.
Then he began to speak and taught them, saying, "Do not think I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have come not to abolish, but to fulfill."
What we learn from the gospel stories is not that Jesus was not Jewish, quite the opposite. He's completely embedded in the Judaism of his time.
Was Jesus a Jew? Of course Jesus was a Jew. He was born of a Jewish mother in Galilee, a Jewish part of the world. All of his friends, associates, colleagues, disciples, all of them were Jews. He regularly worshipped in Jewish communal worship, what we call synagogues. He preached from Jewish texts from the Bible. He celebrated the Jewish festivals. He was born, lived, died, taught as a Jew. Nowadays, there are temples and synagogues everywhere you go. There's not a Jewish community in the world that doesn't have a synagogue, and many of them are called temples. In this period, however, we should always remember that there is only one temple. That's the one temple in Jerusalem.
For Jews living in the time of Jesus, the temple in Jerusalem was the center of their religious life.
The Jewish historian Josephus has a very memorable line. He says, "One temple for the one God." The Jews saw themselves as a unique people with one God alone, and this one God of this one special people had one temple. And that's a very powerful idea, reflecting accurately, I think, the historical truth that the temple was a very powerful unifying source within the Jewish community. So this was...
I want to pause right there and just say, I think it's significant, I don't know that they get into it, that he says it's a powerful unifying force in the Jewish community. The Jewish community was very diverse. There were people that were all over the map in terms of what they thought, in terms of what their apocalyptic feelings, what was going to happen, their eschatological feelings, what was going to happen in the future. There were a lot of different opinions, but the temple unified them all, except there were these Essenes and others that had, dropped out of society altogether. But even then, they were still focused on the temple and the fact that they thought, or not the fact, but their view that eventually they would be back, they would be in control and be able to administer the sacraments properly. So the temple was the focal point, even of the people who had dropped out. It was central to everything.
The one most sacred place on earth, the one place on earth where the earth rises up and the heavens somehow descend just enough that they just touch. This is the only one place in the entire earth where this was so.
The temple in Jerusalem was the symbolic part of the country. Jews everywhere, if they chose to, if they were pious, would put aside part of their income. It's sort of like the way Christmas clubs operate now. You'd put aside money explicitly to be spent having a party in Jerusalem.
Although the temple was the centerpiece of Jewish life and worship, Judaism was not a state religion.
There's no such thing as a state church. It's not a monolithic religious or cultural entity at this time. Indeed, what we're seeing more and more through the research and the archaeological discoveries is how diverse Judaism was in this period.
Sometimes reading ancient sources is like overhearing family quarrels in a distant room. And some of the most endearing aspects, I can say this because I don't live in the first century, but the most endearing aspects of reading this evidence that we still have is overhearing the lively quarrels. I mean, people who weren't priests at all would have absolutely firm opinions on how the priests should be doing their business.
That sound familiar?
There will have been a whole wide variety of groups in Jerusalem and perhaps in the countryside as a whole. These are the revolutionary groups who took their religious understanding of what Judaism was and turned that into political program, political agenda. We must destroy the Roman Empire, or we must destroy Jews who cooperate with the Roman Empire.
We now know that other groups had even more extreme views, and their ideas shed new light on Jesus' own message.
One of the best examples of the vibrantly different thought that's at work in Judaism in this period is, of course, now what we know from the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls. As you leave Jerusalem and go to the south and to the east toward the Dead Sea, the terrain changes rapidly.
This doesn't have a whole lot to do with the sermon, but I think it's really interesting and it's got some great scenery, so we'll play it.
And starkly. You move off gradually from rolling hillside through the ravines, and it becomes stark and desolate. It's dry, it's arid, it's rocky, and it's rough. And then all of a sudden, within a span of only about 13 miles, the entire terrain drops out in front of you at the surface of the Dead Sea. It is in that rugged cliff face on the banks of the Dead Sea that the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered at the site known as Kibbet Qumran. The Dead Sea Scrolls are usually thought to have been produced by a group known as the Essenes. And the Essenes are a group that literally abandoned Jerusalem, it seems, in protest against the way the temple was being run. And they go to the desert to get away from what they see to be the worldliness of Jerusalem and the worldliness of the temple.
The Manual of Discipline, or in Hebrew, Serach HaYachad, envisages a community living in almost total isolation. A community that is self-contained, that is governed very strictly. There is an oath of entry. It is very much a monastic community.
Everyone who wishes to join the congregation of the elect must pledge himself to live according to the rule of the community, to love all the children of light, and to hate all the children of darkness.
I would interject here in the discussion on cults that what you had there in Jerusalem, of course, is a cult in the proper sense, that this is the location of worship, this is where the established authority was and so forth for communal worship according to the Torah. I would say that what you had in the community of the of Essenes, if that's who they were, the community there where the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, is also a cult, because they were putting themselves in opposition to the established central location. They were saying, you come here and you have to be loyal to us and not to anyone else. And so this is, I think, a good illustration, at least in my opinion, a good illustration of cult in the academic sense, that this is a center of worship. And here we have with the community out there near the Dead Sea, you have a cult in the negative sense, where we're going to be loyal to one another, we're going to be different than everybody else, and we're going to be special, and we have special understanding.
The Essenes are what we might best call an apocalyptic sect of Judaism. An apocalyptic sect is one that thinks of itself as, first of all, the true form of the religion.
By apocalyptic expectation, I mean that some group has an apocalypsis, in Greek, a revelation that God is going to finally solve the problem of injustice, unrighteousness, evil in the world by totally eradicating the evil. That's the terrible price of apocalypse. There's going to be a lot of very dead people. Totally eradicating evil, and we, the good, whoever we are going to live with God, be it heaven on earth or earth in heaven, forever in justice and holiness and righteousness.
Among the Dead Sea Scrolls, we hear not of just one Messiah, but at least two Messiahs. Some of their writings talk about a Messiah of Aaron, a priestly figure who will come to restore the temple at Jerusalem to its proper purity and worship of God. But there's also a Messiah of David, that is a kind of kingly figure who will come to lead the war.
The Qumran scrolls reveal a variety of scenarios for the end of days. The best known one, perhaps, is the scroll called The War of the Sons of Light against the Sons of Darkness. And at some point, there will be a major battle, a cataclysmic struggle, not just between people, but also between cosmic forces, the cosmic forces of evil and the cosmic forces of good. And needless to say, this will end with the victory for the Sons of Light. In other words, for the group itself.
Now, we typically think of this as reflecting a belief in the end of the world. But in fact, that's not exactly what they thought. They use language like the end, or the last things, or the last days. But what they mean is the present evil age is coming to an end. This is really more in the vein of a transformation of the present social order and a return to a kind of golden age of statehood and independence.
I'll interject here. This is my opinion and my understanding, my perspective. Jesus came, says, preaching the gospel of the kingdom of God. And sometimes we think, if we're not careful, I think, we may think that Jesus is preaching about, or was preaching about, this eternal kingdom where there would be no human beings, this thing that we read about in the end of the book of Revelation. When, in fact, I think it would be good for us, I've started to think about this more, when we're reading the prophecies of the end time and so forth, to make sure that we are clear on the distinction between what happens while there are still humans around and what happens beyond that. That Jesus was preaching the gospel of a kingdom that involved flesh and blood. that he was going to be the king, and the saints are going to rule with him for 1,000 years over people. And that's still, it's what this individual is talking about here, that there's a restructuring of the social order. But it doesn't mean the end of everything. There is also going to be a time when it says the heavens and, you know, the earth, or the earth's going to melt with a fervent heat, and there's going to be new heavens and new earth, and that's something different. That's beyond the kingdom, specifically, that is, the messianic kingdom that's going to be on earth with human beings. So I think there's a distinction here, and I think he makes a good point.
So it's really kind of a political expectation. It's not otherworldly. In fact, when it comes, it'll be right here and right now.
History offers no evidence that Jesus was influenced by the Essenes, but their apocalyptic challenge struck chords that reverberated throughout the homeland and echoed through the message of a prophet known as John the Baptist. We don't know to what extent Jesus remained faithful to John's apocalyptic message, but at some point after his baptism by John,
skipping John,
Jesus seems to have embarked on his career as a preacher.
After he had said this, he went on ahead, going up to Jerusalem.
Moving to Jerusalem, Jesus was moving from the territory ruled by Herod Antipas to the territory ruled directly by Rome through a prefect, Pontius Pilate.
Pontius Pilate was the governor from 26 to 36. And so that places us very clearly within the early period of Roman rule. These are some of our most important and clearest dates for the activities of Jesus' life. When Jesus actually died, we're not absolutely sure. Some people would say as early as maybe 27, maybe some others as late as 33. But we do know it's under Pilate.
Pontius Pilatus, Praefectus Judaeae. Pontius Pilate, governor of Judea.
And we know of him as an effective and a fairly ruthless administrator of his territory, the area of Judea. And there are several episodes recorded by Josephus where eschatological prophets emerge, and Pilate has no hesitation in eliminating them or in suppressing episodes of potential conflict or revolt within that territory.
People from all over the empire went to Jerusalem on Passover. It's one of the most populated times in the whole city. It's a madhouse. There are extra animals being brought up, sheep, because of the Passover holiday. There are pilgrims coming in from everywhere. And Jesus comes up to town, too. He could have stayed home and had Passover in the Galilee, but he didn't. He's up in Jerusalem because this is important. Pilate would get nervous when there were crowds of Jews, and of course he was legally responsible to be up in Jerusalem when it was the most crowded of all. He would leave this very nice, plush seaside town in Caesarea, which was, you know, a nice pagan city, plenty of pagan altars, all the stuff he wanted, and have to go up to Jerusalem where all these Jews were congregating and stay there for crowd control until the holiday was over. He was in a bad mood already by the time he got to town. And Passover would fray anybody's nerves.
If you were a pilgrim coming to Jerusalem in these days, you would walk through the streets of this magnificent city. As you approach the Temple Mount, you come up to this massive, monumental complex that we call the Temple. And there are grand staircases up which one can go and get up to the top. And you come out up on top of the platform in the outer precincts of the temple complex. The the soldiers that were garrisoned in Jerusalem would have been stationed in the nearby fortress called the Antonia, which literally stands adjacent to the temple complex and kind of looks over it. They could keep an eye on things there. And of course, everyone in the temple knew they were there, too.
Particularly at Passover, which is a holiday that vibrates with this incredible historical memory of national creation and freedom. And the Roman soldiers standing along the colonnade of the temple looking down at Jews celebrating this. So it's a politically and religiously electric holiday.
Then Jesus entered the temple and drove out all who were selling and buying in the temple. And he overturned the tables of the money changers.
The difficulty with the story of Jesus and the money changers...
I'm going to end that there. I didn't identify it when I started, but these videos are from PBS Home Video. The series was called From Jesus to Christ. It's a story of the first Christians, and let's see if I can get this. And it has a lot of good information there, and some of those clips I played just as much for the scenery, so that you would get an idea of the massiveness of the temple and the way it just kind of had a position where it overshadowed the city. And I wanted to give you a feeling for that. Next time I speak about church history, we will go into the destruction of the temple and what followed. I think it'll probably wait till after the holy days. But I hope this gives you a bit of the perspective of Jesus and of the early church and what the temple meant to the average citizen of Judea or the average Jew that lived in the region. It wasn't just a building, and it wasn't just a place where the priests were. It was really the center of their lives and the center of their worldview. And apocalyptic, in their minds, they were looking forward to a time when things were going to change and the roles were going to be reversed. And they would be, they could read the prophecies of Isaiah and Jeremiah and so forth. And they were looking forward to the time when God was going to act. And they thought it was going to be in their lifetime, or maybe the lifetime of their children. They didn't realize it was going to be way off in the future. But that was their mindset at the time. And when things went very sour in the 60s in Jerusalem and in the surrounding area, the whole world changed, or the whole Christian world changed. Maybe the way that our world changed quite a bit in the 60s here, their world changed quite a bit in the 60s. So next time I talk about church history, that's where we'll be.